Welcome to Bitches on Comics. I'm Essie Fleenor, and I am delighted to be here one final time. Yes, you heard that right. This is the last episode of Bitches on Comics. We have loved the last 6+ years with you, talking about comics, talking about bitches who are in comics, and talking about sci-fi, fantasy, horror, all the things that just make us queer and trans folks feel magical. It has been a real blast, and you know, you gotta sometimes recognize when it's the moment. And I did a lot of crying today thinking about this being the moment, but it's such a delight to be here with my delightful co-host, the one and only Signe Noir. How you doing today, my darling?
The horrors persist. Yes, Yeah, basically that's where I'm at right now. I'm okay. It's midterms for me right now. So that's awesome. And yeah, I'm even though I'm sad about us closing this out, I am also very excited to see where this leads us to, you know, other exciting projects, because we're both creative people and I know that we have a lot to say. And especially because, like, our voices are very much needed right now. So this is not the end.
No.
Of Signe and Essie.
No, I have a turning point. I'm walking around. You know, some Green Day. I want to do a little semi-sonic, like, every new beginning comes from summer. Anyways, I guess I'm just feeling nostalgic for my youth. And even, you know, I'm so excited because we are going to go out on a high note. We can't help ourselves. We are delighted to have here today the luminary, the person who has maybe grossed me out with their writing more than like anyone, the wonderful Gretchen Felger-Martin. Gretchen, thank you for being here with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you guys for inviting me.
Oh, you know, we were so excited to talk to you about, you know, I read Manhunt and I was like, Signe, oh my God, you got to read Manhunt. And then I was reading Cuckoo and I was like, oh my God, we got to talk to Gretchen on the pod. And then some unfortunate shit that made things timely came around and we're going to get into that. And that will be a mixed bag, I'm sure. But, you know, I'm looking forward to, yeah, hearing more from you on that front. But first, I want to give you an actual real introduction beyond me just being like, you gross me out and I love it, which is that Gretchen is the author of Manhunt, which was named the number one best book of 2022 by Vulture and one of the best horror novels of 2022 by Esquire, Library Journal, and Paste. I think it definitely earned that title. And Cuckoo debuted on the USA Today bestseller list. And you write both fiction and film criticism, right, for your Patreon? Is that the case?
That's right.
Oh, so cool. And you have got to go check out. You're always doing the coolest analysis of horror films, you know, old and new. It's really delightful to see what you're doing on your Patreon. So make sure you check that out. We will have a link to it. We will give you the call sign. Can't be the right word for it. URL. Oh man. At the end of the episode, but I will put a link in this episode's description. You can trust future me to actually put the links in. So wherever you are, if you're driving, don't click it yet, but remember to do it when you get home. If you are on public transit and you're not going to elbow anybody, feel free to click that arrow, go on down and click the link and make sure you follow Gretchen on Patreon. You know, we're so pumped to have you here today. And I know Signe had like a good question to kick us off with.
Yeah. So I love horror and I've made my career as a filmmaker, essentially one that has always invested in horror as a genre, specifically for like Black queer folks, because that level of horror definitely has like a different connotation in like so many ways, especially within this sociopolitical fear that we exist in. But I am so curious to know about where your love for horror began and what inspired you to work within that medium.
So I would say that the very first time I can remember being really attracted to something that frightened me is when my father read me The Hobbit when I was a little kid. And
That's so real. I was thinking about the cartoon, like that animated movie that like fucked me up. I was like, why am I watching this in English class?
It was specifically the riddles in the dark scene. Like, you know, it introduces all these ideas of being eaten alive and this really grotesque, debased setting and just how tense and weird it is in the middle of this kid's adventure book. And it gave me nightmares. I had nightmares about Gollum for weeks. And I still, you know, I wanted to go back and read it again. I found it so enthralling.
I feel like J.R.R. Tolkien, like, I feel like when people think about Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit, they always think about like the whimsical, like, elements of it. So whether it be like with the elves, even though I think the elves are the most terrifying.
The elves are scary.
They're scary.
Oh, because they're from a pure race? Is that what we are concerned about? Do we not like the pure race?
Okay, see, like, I wasn't trying to go that deep so early in the conversation, but since you said it, sure, yes, yes. exactly. But, like, I actually just recently watched Lord of the Rings for the first time in, like, 20 years, I think, since it came out, because I was really into it when I was in high school. And I forgot like how terrifying like a lot of the scenes in the movie are, but also I feel like it's very timely for right now with what's going on in like a very like weird way. But I feel like when it comes to like horror that talks about like mythology and anything like that, it's definitely subjective because J.R.R. Tolkien was a British writer. So like I think about like my movies that I make. And my latest movie that I made was about transgenerational trauma and how our memories of our ancestors and what they did can sometimes live on through their own like line because like those traumas, those memories were never reckoned with. And, you know, those who come from them like still have not like learned how to heal from those types of things. And so I feel like my understanding of horror like definitely has like a spiritual like meaning, but also very much rooted in horror. And when I read Black Flame, I automatically, like, so I love Clive Barker a lot. Like, Clive Barker is awesome. And I actually just got his Night of the Living Dead London series comic, which is amazing. If y'all have not read it, y'all totally should. But, like, Clive Barker, I feel, is probably one of the best contemporary voices in horror. And I just want to know, like, what Clive Barker's work means to you, and also what is your favorite work from Clive Barker?
So my favorite Clive Barker works are his short stories, In the Hills, The Cities, and Jacqueline S., Her Will and Testament, I would say are my two favorites. But I also love his big doorstopper horror fantasy, Imagica. And what I love about Barker is that he's so concerned with the body and with sensuality, not just in the sense of like sexual appeal, but physical sensation, which is the lens that I tend to write through too. I'm much more interested in what we're feeling and how we're interpreting it than I am in more conventional approach to narrative. I also love how horny Barker is. He's a weird dude who, you know, came up as trade, which I also identify with. I was a professional dominatrix for a couple years, and I really relish any chance to read someone else who came out of the gutter, because horror, but more broadly literature in general, is so upper middle class and rich and correspondingly pretty tedious to pick through these perspectives. But Barker understands what it's like to be reviled and outside the protection of society. And I find that really compelling.
Yeah, like horror being a part of like the upper middle class, like that's very apparent because like it kind of feels like when I watch horror movies and then I see like people leaving, their doors are unlocked, and I'm just like, y'all obviously never grew up like in the projects. So like it's like I did not grow up with like our doors open, or like my fears did not include like some random man in a mask like hiding in the bushes like in my suburban home. Like that's just not my reality. And then I think about like Hellraiser, and when I first saw that, which I definitely should not have seen that movie when I was a kid, but I stayed up and watched it when my mom was asleep, and it like I was like, okay, this is definitely what I want to do. And I feel like, yeah, I agree with you. Clive Barker definitely is like on the outside fringe. And I'm also curious to know, like, what is your relationship with horror filmmaking in particular?
Well, horror filmmaking is really how I came to horror, especially as an adult. And I love it. And it's the lens through which I approach my own writing. You know, when I'm working, I'm thinking about Derek Jarman's sets on The Devils, or I'm thinking about the special effects in The Fly and Dead Ringers. And I'm thinking about The Thing and Christine and, you know, the all these Carpenter classics. Like, this is the language in which I first learned what horror looked like and sounded like, and how it communicated with its audience. So I think that horror movies have always been closer and more immediate to me than any other form.
Totally. Yeah, I was actually going to ask about Cronenberg, because you mentioned that, like, Clive's inspiration of, like, the body and, like, sensations, like, Cronenberg definitely touches upon that.
Yeah.
In a lot of his movies, which I also feel like, which is why remakes can never be made of Cronenberg stuff, because he just, like, has a very particular, like, touch on the things that he does.
Yeah, I think the only way to reapproach Cronenberg's work is to, like, radically reinterpret it, like, the way that Alice Birch did with the Dead Ringers miniseries, which is a really incredible piece of television that I did not expect to be good at all. Dead Ringers is, I usually say it's my favorite Cronenberg movie, but the show is just doing something really, really different, with incredibly different focus, very differently inflected performances, and it really manages to bring something new to, you know, an already really beautiful and thoughtful piece of work.
Agreed. Yeah, I think my favorite Cronenberg piece would have to be The Brood, and that's just because of, like, the ending. I love the ending. I'm sorry. I'm just,
it's
like,
so good.
For real.
The Brood rips, man.
Yeah, yeah. No, The Brood is amazing.
Any movie that opens with Oliver Reed demanding that some guy call him daddy is going to get at least 4 stars for me.
Facts. Can you just give me, like, a little bit of background of what inspired Black Flame?
Yeah, so there are a number of sources of inspiration for Black Flame. Obviously, there's some Hellraiser in the DNA. My own lifelong love of the idea of cursed movies. One of the first horror movies I saw was The Ring, the American adaptation of Ringu. Gemma Files' experimental film. The Max Headroom video takeover, things like that. And then on top of that, there's also, in the 1980s, my family sort of adopted this older woman named Helena Mantel into our family. She had moved down from New York after coming here from Poland in the wake of World War II, and did not have any children of her own, and became really invested in me and later my sibling, and was kind of a grandmother to us. And she is the person who first explained the Holocaust to me. I think I was 5 or 6 years old, and I wanted to know what the tattoo on her arm meant. And she gave me, you know, a child's explanation, but not a dumbed down or disrespectful explanation. She told me that the Nazis had killed millions of people, and it had become so huge that they had needed to number their prisoners. And that, you know, I mean, I think that has a pretty profound impact on every human when we learn about that. She was in Auschwitz for quite some time and managed to escape and walk to Switzerland and then get to the United States. The thought that she still had the willingness and ability to connect with other people and believe that people could be good after that has really stayed with me for my entire life. And I wanted to write this book for her as a way of telling her that I still have her principles and that I'm grateful for them and want to pass them on.
That's really beautiful. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, that was I'm very emotional. Thank you.
Yeah.
I think that feels so real to what I read in Black Flame. I can feel that thrumming heart of call a genocide a genocide. I can feel that call to deep ethical and moral choices in life that aren't easy to make when you live in deeply transphobic, homophobic, Zionist world. You know, there's many
in a lot of ways,
fatphobic. Yes, the list can continue, obviously. And it's, please, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no, that's okay. I was just going to say, in a lot of ways, I see the decision that some people make to remain closeted in order to stay part of a world that hates them and that brings them no joy as very similar to the way in which people refuse to readdress their own principles and beliefs regarding war crimes and unjust societies. Once you start admitting that things don't make sense or that things need to change, you lose your sense of stability. Mm-hmm. Whether or not that stability is based on anything good or even remotely defensible.
Mm. Mm.
In a way, it's like suicide.
Mm-hmm.
You would see this with, during COVID, there were all those people who would deny even on their deathbeds that COVID existed and was real. And it's because it's easier than admitting you were wrong. Like, it's literally easier to just die.
And that's,
I can't even argue with that one. Like, yeah. I definitely remember reading stories about that, about just like how people
refusing oxygen and
like all of those things, and just like refusing to like actually admit the fact that, you know, their ignorance was the one that like led to their eventual demise, and also their lack of accountability would also just make that whole process 10 times more painful than what it needed to be.
Right. Because if they stopped and said, okay, I guess the things I was told were untrue, then they have to reckon with the fact that their luminaries are either ignorant or malicious or both. Mm-hmm. And that the entire society that they've built up around them is infected with those things and needs to be uprooted and rebuilt. And that's just really hard. People do not like to change. And, you know, that's the sort of tradition that I see Ellen in, the main character. She has destroyed her own life to avoid having to change.
Mm-hmm. Children and parents.
Yeah.
This kind of, I'm obsessed with you, but I fucking hate you. And it goes both ways, in especially for Ellen and in Black Flame. But then I also was just deeply moved from the opening chapter in Cuckoo with how willing you were to mine that resentment that no one's supposed to talk about on either side. And I see the way Ellen's story goes, and, you know, her sort of culmination with her father, then shortly after culmination with her mother, like, holy shit. Like, that reckoning of, going back to what Senye was talking about, this is what generational trauma looks like. This is what internalized homophobia, internalized transphobia looks like. And what I really like that you layer, and if anything in here is sticky and you like it, we can tear it apart, but you layer in this questioning of one's sanity. Mm-hmm. And so Ellen is wondering if she is losing her mind. At the same time, she's wondering if she made all the wrong decisions in deciding to go back in the closet. And when I pair those two things with what you said earlier about destabilizing the normalcy of a deeply unjust society, there's just something really meaty in here about, you got to lose your mind to change the world. You got to lose your mind to get out of the closet. But then also, maybe you're not the one losing your mind.
Right. No, I think that's a really good observation. So often a breakdown prefigures radicalization and big personal changes. The ways that we build ourselves, our senses of self, it's often brittle and can't accept large influxes of new information or new ways of seeing the world. And so you need to smash it before you can create something in its place.
I love that.
And I also think that people who are experiencing mental distress and acute mental health have a really clear view of what society wants and doesn't want, sometimes for the first time in their lives, you know?
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to tradition,
I feel. For
like,
sure.
I have a saying that tradition is just peer pressure from dead people. And I feel like that is, it's the realest thing. But like, I'm also, you know, like, and my coming out story, like, I had no choice but to come out. I was actually outed by a family member who saw me making out with my partner at the time. And that resulted in me being homeless for like a year. And it was ultimately, as much as this sounds cliche, but like, once I dove myself into like the punk scene in Chicago, like, that's legitimately what saved my life, because I met like other like queer and trans folks that were also like on this trajectory of trying to break all of the things that we were indoctrinated with and try to figure out what life or what world do we create where we actually feel that we can be ourselves without having to deny ourselves. I would just say any type of love for living, because I feel like that's like the ultimate thing. And that's why shaming is like such a big thing, because they want you to feel guilty for being who you are. Whereas like, who made the standard? Like, who said that you are actually like the base? You know what I'm saying?
No, for sure. I mean, in so many instances, it's really about a parent or an authority figure's discomfort with being confronted by the idea that they could have done different things. It's tremendously upsetting and destabilizing for them. And instead of sitting with that, they reflect it back on their child. American parents very often do hate their own children and hurt them and see this as an important legal and spiritual right to retain. Also, I'm really fucking sorry that happened to you. That sucks. But as I also say to my friends who get divorced, also congratulations.
No, basically, I mean, like, honestly, if that hadn't happened, I would not be sitting here today, you know? So, like, that's pretty much how I look at it, because I've met so many amazing people. I met a chosen family that I've had, like, for life. And, you know, it is what it is. But, like, I also am, like, you know? And, like, also, I'm a former sex worker also. So, like, I am also, like, you know, I am who I am, and if you don't like it, then fuck it, right? Like, so that's pretty much like what that lesson taught me. I mean, that's pretty much where I'm at right now. Even like during this, I mean, especially during this time, because like, get fucked, right? So I definitely saw some parts of myself in Ellen, like with in some regards, especially with the compulsory heterosexuality.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Like there was like, I literally had to put down the book for a brief second, because I had to like really like marinate on that, because like I've had some moments where I've literally thought that like people in my family fell victim to that. And that is why a lot of things that they did and said is because of that compulsory like heterosexuality, or just like being denied themselves, you know? And like, yeah, parents, a lot of American parents probably do hate their children. I also feel like they're envious of their children, because whatever like times are now, I feel like we can agree that like, you know, when we were growing up, it was a lot worse, like basically.
Oh my God, it was so bad.
It was so fucking bad. And like, it's funny because I'm in school now and like a lot of Gen Z kids like are very much into the 90s and being like, oh, you know, like it was so cool. And I'm like, listen,
It was like standard
practice to just call somebody a fag, like just like on like like unprovoked. You know what I'm saying? Like, and it was okay. Like on television, like the transphobia like was crazy. Like there were just like a lot of things that like, you know, the aesthetic of like the 90s and early 2000s.
Oh like, no, it's nuts. Like
push away.
Like, fucking girl, there were supermodels doing heroin to lose weight. Like the 90s were not fun.
Heroin chic. Heroin chic. Yeah. So you'd be like, we're just not eating. Got it. All right, bet.
You remember that everybody like eviscerated Kate Winslet for being fat in Titanic? That formed me as a fucking person. I was like, oh, you're all pieces of shit.
Like she was like a size 6, bro. Like at least she was like a size 6. I'm like, that's fat. And also that is inherently anti-black as fuck. I just want to like throw that out there.
It was Ellie crazy. Of the Beast shit. Oh yeah. I'm like, I wouldn't go back. Wouldn't go back for anything. No. Thank you.
You could not beat me back into the 90s.
You could fucking try though. I'm not gonna do it. You know, something that I think is on topic, I think. We'll see if I reach there. Is Ellen is a person who is trying again. Ellen was out. Ellen had a girlfriend. Ellen was a little filmmaker. She was a little crazy lesbian in the fucking woods. Like, she was doing it. And her mom called her back in. And she came trotting back. But for a while there, she was fighting with her parents about Palestine. She was fighting with them about queer and trans rights. She was trying to make a relationship with Freddie work. She was really all in. And then that moment comes and she was like, no, I can't step into the breach. I can't step away from money. I can't step away from family. And I can't step away from security. We find through the course of Black Flame, which is why it fucking rips as a book, that Ellen can be pushed to that level. and that she can find that gut, that ability to stand on her own two fucking feet and know who she is. But she can't fix what she did to Freddie. And for listeners who may not have read it, Freddie is the ex from when she was in college, when she was, you know, living her filmmaker lesbian days. And I think there's something really important in this. Yeah, she gets another chance to come out. Yeah, she gets another chance to like reject the narrative her family is trying to put on her that is compulsory heterosexuality, that is Zionist, that is, you know, rich, that is anything's okay as long as the bank is full. All those pieces, you know, she has a chance to reject them, but that doesn't mean she can fix what she did to someone she loved once. And I think that that to me feels like real accountability. That to me feels like what it feels like to really fucking hurt someone.
Yeah, it was really important for me to get that right. You know, I find it kind of pat and narratively insulting when books use a love interest as like a prop for another character's growth. Mm. Not because I think it's like inherently morally wrong, although obviously in real life it is, but just because it's boring and doesn't take into account the ways that people grow apart and change when these things have happened between them. You know, Freddie goes out with Ellen one final time to get a piece of pie. And Ellen is just not a big deal to her anymore. You know, like Ellen has clung to her for a decade plus, but Freddie has gone on and had her own life and is not going to squish herself down to go back to this woman who did not treat her right. And I think, you know, also Freddie is trans and you don't see a lot of situations in modern fiction where a trans woman has like any self-respect in a romantic context. There's this really pervasive idea that if someone wants us, we should just be grateful. And that's really not how I saw Freddie. You know, she's skilled. She's beautiful. She has a lot of friends. She's not someone who would just come crawling back if you snapped your fingers at her. She's also used to having nothing, and Ellen isn't. And in a lot of ways, that's the most significant divide between them.
For Freddie, that is a form of freedom that Ellen can't reach for.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Not till the end.
Yeah, Ellen gets there in a different way.
Yeah.
Ellen, no spoilers. Woo! No spoilers.
Ellen. Ellen. Mm-hmm. There is a line that I think appeared in both Black Flame and Cuckoo, slightly different. So I'm going to paraphrase it. We're typically in someone's mind. And I think what happens is we're in one character's perspective and they look at another character and they think something along the lines of, how could anyone see anything but a girl looking at her? Or how could anyone see anything but a boy looking at him? And that knocked the air right out of my chest because I think that all the time looking at my wife. I am just like, I don't get it. I like, she'll tell me these fucking fairy ass princess stories of being like 8 years old, fucking tra-la-la in the woods, feeding deer from her hands. I'm like, what part of this? Like, how could you not? Like, I'm so confused. And that felt like such a nod to our communities and such a promise that we see us, even if other people don't. And in fact, it's not hard to see us. It's actually very easy to see each other for who we are. And since it came up in the two, I think, or I'm just lying and decided it's in all of your books because I liked it so much. I'm like, you're like, I definitely wrote that only once. I'm like, it's in every book, every five sentences. No, just kidding. It was just such a touching idea. I was curious for you why it matters.
Well, I put it in Cuckoo as sort of an homage to my partner who was nominally cis when we got together. And after my girlfriend and I spent an afternoon hanging out with them, we turned to each other and we're like, what's the clock on them coming out? And they did come out like a few weeks later. Mm. And I remember there was this very sweet moment where they were in my arms and they were like, you could really tell that I was some kind of guy. And I was like, baby, you have a tramp stamp that says I'm your man.
The signs were there.
Yeah, literally.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, you know, and like, seeing someone that way and being seen that way is something that can keep you alive and keep you warm.
Yeah, I think it can. I really think it can. There's one other, and I think it was in Manhunt and Black Flame. It's another one when we're in a character's perspective and they see someone and they think, that's the fattest person I ever saw. And I remember, I think you were talking to someone on Blue Sky or Twitter, I don't remember. And someone was like basically suggesting that your books were fatphobic, which is just like Bananarama for like various reasons.
I hear this a lot.
And you can't see me. I am also a fat person. So listeners can't see me, but I am a fat person. So I get to have a fucking fat opinion. Okay. And my fat ass opinion is that that's what one of the things people were glomming onto is the idea of the fattest person they'd ever seen. But I don't understand why it's bad to say the truth.
Yeah. I mean, you have to believe that fatness is bad.
Yeah.
And that you should never admit that someone is fat.
Or that like they would have roles that would have to be moved during sex, or that a lover would notice a jiggle, or any myriad number of things.
Yeah, these are all things that I've had people both fat and thin get really, really upset with me over. And all I've ever really been able to say is like, well, I guess we have very different ways of relating to our own and our partner's fatness. Like, you know, it's fine if you feel uncomfortable talking about the physical actuality of your body, but it's not my fucking problem.
Exactly.
I think it's beautiful when someone has rolls. I think stretch marks are gorgeous and it's nice to lick them. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the fat body is a site of sexual desire, whether or not we admit it. And if we admit it, we gain access to all this exquisite language that has a chance to hopefully start to repair the damage society has done to us for existing while fat.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this is a side note, but my wife was reading an Irish cookbook. I'm Irish. And in the cookbook, it was like the Irish ate a lot of fatty meals right before winter because if you didn't have extra fat on you, you were a fucking liability. And I'm like, so I literally am genetically made to be fat and y'all are mad about it? Like my... Like generations and generations and thousands of years of my ancestors were like, no, we need fat bitches. Okay. So let's get some fat bitches. And I'm like, here I am being a fat bitch. And suddenly it's too much.
I know. I think all the time about my like Paleolithic ancestors looking down at me like, oh my God, she's so prepared for winter. We did so good, you guys.
Nailed it. I love that so much. She's so prepared for winter. Amazing.
I was going to say in relation to that, like, and I mentioned that, you know, fat phobia is inherently anti-Black. In comparison, like with me growing up, if you were skinny, it meant that like you were not eating like at home. You know what I mean? And it had like a negative connotation because like, you know, Black folks, like we have like hips, we have, you know, like curves, whatever you want to call it. And like people make fun of the fact that like, you know, what a Black woman would look like, you know, like only makes her desirable to Black men, or like because she is heavy set. Like I think about like the mammy stereotype. She's clearly just there to be a nurse, or like she's just like this non-sexual entity that exists like in this household because the master doesn't want to fuck her, which historically speaking, that did not happen.
No. So,
you get what I'm saying? So I'm like, it's just like, you know, that rejection of fat phobia inherently is also calling for like the downfall of white supremacy.
Yes.
It's all interconnected.
Listen, if I'm saying any one thing, it's fuck Nazis. These people have trapped us in a world of smallness and misery and self-hatred and suspicion and distrust and a fundamental rejection of beauty. And that's no way to live. You can't live like that. It's horrible. You know, fat people and Black people and disabled people and fucking crazy people are my community. And I have a great life. I'm very happy. I can't bear to look at this shit and let it pass by uncommented upon. I want to do whatever I can to get my nails in it and fucking rip it apart.
I endorse saying fuck Nazis.
I'm gonna file paperwork to change my middle name to Fuck Nazis. That's my plan for next week, but it's just a lot of paperwork. Yeah, no, Fuck Nazis for the record.
There's also just a point of curiosity for readers. Jack Henry Abbott's The Belly of the Beast really digs into the connections between fat phobia and anti-blackness. Well worth a read. Very, very cool.
Yeah, you got furious scribbling on two mics. We're like, yes, yes, yes. And what else is my reading list? I'm like, oh, what films do I need to catch next? Okay, I've got Dead Ringers, The Brood. Okay, what else? What else? That's how I always feel during episodes. You know, just while we're talking about fat people, I think that one of the things that moved me so much in Manhunt was the treatment of Indy as a fat character who was not able to just escape. Like, I think that so many zombie stories, and this is not, it's not exactly zombies, but for the sake of comparison, is that okay to talk about?
Yeah, it's in the wheelhouse.
Okay. Or any kind of escape, monster escape story, like where you're running away. So often they just keep running. And it's like, yeah, I would be left behind and dead if all my friends were like, we'll just keep running. I'm like, okay, bye, I guess. I have a lot of useful skills, but fuck me, I guess. And I love that that is what actually creates some of the deep tension of Manhunt, is the unwillingness to leave her. And at one point she even tells them to, and they're like, are you fucking nuts? Like, no. And I think that's another sort of, let's say, facet of dignity that you give to characters who maybe would traditionally be denied that. So Indy's like a fat woman who is given the dignity of people care about her. And I feel insane saying that out loud because that's such a like basic ass thing, but it's not common. It's not in fiction.
It's not. It's not at all. And it's, you know, it's based on my own experiences with physical disability. I have a messed up hip and spine. And I'm fat and I cannot walk very far. You know, I can do okay if you give me a rest every minute or so. But like, if something like this happened, I'd be fucked. Mm-hmm. And I was sick and tired of reading apocalypse stories that just decided to broom everyone who is disabled or inconvenient to the narrative and then start off with, you know, a bunch of fucking thin white people who I don't want to look at on even a good day.
Yeah. Who you kill off in your apocalypse sure says a lot about you as a writer.
Boy, it sure fucking does.
I'm like, oh, V for Vendetta. Is that what would happen? I wonder why you thought that.
Or even just The Walking Dead. I always really mad about that shit. I'm just like, y'all are in the South.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Y'all are in the South? Like,
fucking The Walking Dead is fascist.
Ugh. Oh, 1,000%.
Nightmare. You know, they 1,000%. Had, I know it happened during Trump's first campaign. It came out that they were specifically targeting viewers of The Walking Dead with ads.
Oh my God.
Because they were more likely to be reactionary.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
That whole show is just like, all violence is acceptable if it threatens the in-group. That's it. That's all it has to say. And the gestures it makes at diversity are insulting, frankly.
I'm like, what show are we talking about? It could be so many. I know. We're talking about The Walking Dead.
Just yeah, because like I think about like how there were like these offshoots of shows. Like so when I was in high school, I actually read The Walking Dead when it first came out. And I think the only reason I kept with it is because I love the character Michonne. Mm. Because, you know, black strong black woman trope aside, I like the fact that she did have some autonomy within, like, her life of, like, trying to navigate that area. Because, one, she just was like, I do not trust any of you. Like, all of y'all, like, I just don't trust you. But also just the image of her, like, having two white, like, man zombies on a chain and she just is pulling them around and using them as her like defense. Iconic. So I was just like, this is fucking awesome. But Walking Dead, like, yes, it happens in the South, but like you can definitely tell, like, even with their merch, they have like camo merch, they have like hunting merch, the whole like Daryl Dixon thing, like I just, you know what I'm saying? So like I'm so glad that somebody else agrees with me that like that show is hella, hella, hella problematic on so many fucking levels.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Hired to write for DC, and your artist was Jeff Spokes and the letterer Becca Carey. I want to make sure to name them because we want lots of support to go their way.
Amen.
They also got screwed. So on the way to getting screwed. So this was announced in July, I think, maybe June. Mm-hmm. June or July, this series, Red Hood, about Red Hood living in, it's the place next to Gotham.
No, it's actually New Angelique, which is in Louisiana.
Oh, well, I'm a liar. In New Angelique. And Huntress is there too. Is that right?
Yeah.
Ugh, that's why I remember the cover was so iconic. And it was very highly anticipated, adult rated. You are not a new voice. You have multiple books out. I mean, Black Flame came out this summer. Is that right?
Yeah, August.
Okay, so 3 books out at the time that this was slated to be released. A certain white supremacist, neo-Nazi, piece of shit podcaster died while talking shit about Black people. And you were worried about the safety of the bullet and perhaps maybe were... You got some takes out quick that were not seen as very empathetic, but I don't think that's what you were going for. And no, so
I have no empathy for Charlie Kirk.
And why would you?
He was a disgusting little weasel who made the world worse every morning he drew breath.
Yes. These are called
on purpose, too.
On purpose. You know,
like, it's not like he looked weird and it bummed everyone out, although he did and it did. He was like out to make the world a worse place.
That was like his only goal.
Yeah, it's all he ever did.
Yeah. Well, the world was a worse place, and now it's just maybe a little bit better.
Oh, who knows?
So, in the wake of those social media posts, I don't know what happened at this point. I don't know when you found out versus when DC made the public announcement. Do you mind walking us through that a little bit? Is that...
Not at all. I found out the night before they announced. Marie Javins, the editor-in-chief of DC, called me at home at 9:30 and told me they were pulling the book.
Mm. Were you surprised?
Not terribly.
Okay.
I felt bad for Becca and Jeff more than anything. But I know that there's a really intense double standard for what women and trans people can say online before facing consequences.
Yeah.
And if I had, stopped for another second to think, I probably wouldn't have said it just out of deference to Jeff and Becca, who, are really hardworking and talented.
Right.
But as it stands, I believe everything that I said. And, I wouldn't fire someone for saying it.
Yeah, it does seem that when people like the white supremacist in question had horrible things to say about people who were killed by police violence, there were no consequences.
Yeah, he called George Floyd a scumbag.
Thank you. And somehow, though, every Black journalist, trans writer, just existing queer person is supposed to be respectful of a neo-Nazi?
Right. I mean, to me, this is like, firing people for celebrating the death of Joseph Goebbels.
God damn.
Like, what are we doing at this point? I guess we're just collaborating with Nazis, which, to be fair, does appear to be the Democratic strategy at present.
I mean, it's been like that for a minute, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we could go down the line, Clinton, Carter, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You're all like this. This is just power in America.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now it's just running around with its pants off.
Yeah. I was rereading the Comics Journal article on everything. I will link to it in the show notes for anyone who wants to get sort of the long and deep version of it. But I think what really struck me is, and Bitches on Comics released an open letter to DC saying, we condemn the censorship of Gretchen. So if you want to see formal, nice, pretty words, please go to our website and feel free to read that. I'll also link to it here in the show notes. But this is just like our more off-the-cuff conversation with the author, if you will. But I was rereading the Comics Journal And yes, it just struck me that like they were mad at you for doing something you had done many, many, many times.
Oh, yeah. We had an explicit conversation when I was hired about what a loudmouth I am.
And I think you told them that people would try to get you fired every single day that they knew.
Yeah.
And they did. And we know that the motherfucker known as EVS and other Comicsgate bros view this as like a personal victory, that they did it. They got what they wanted.
I mean, I guess they did. You know, I won't be writing Red Hood. It's honestly, it's a job that I took because I wanted to sock away a little money because I have a new nephew and he could use like, you know, every advantage when he's presumably fighting other children for access to clean water in 20 years. But, you know, jokes on Ethan Van Sciver because they still have to pay me. So,
all right.
That man is such a joke.
What a loser. My God.
Just an incredible fucking weenie. The most insecure, pitiful, small-minded little turd I've ever encountered.
This is a great final episode. Who else do you want to talk some shit about?
Someone forgot to flush Ethan Van Sciver.
I'm always just like amazed at people that come for writers. Like, I'm just kind of like, do you want to be read to filth? Or is this, it's like a kink at this point, I feel. Because like,
yeah, I mean, I do think that a lot of fascists have some kind of sexual relationship to humiliation.
Facts. No, actual facts. I mean, they talk and walk around and exist. So
right.
That's humiliating as a fact. So, I mean, I just... Well, like, I've always had to navigate life always knowing that, like, there's a different set of rules for me. And that's always been that way since I was a little kid.
Yep.
And so I kind of get really annoyed at, like, these oblivious, like, white liberals who are just like, this is not the America I live in. This is not the America that I know. And I'm just like, y'all really do live in a fucking bubble.
Did everyone just stop learning shit at 12?
I guess so, because I'm just like,
you're like the America that's
the America I've always known, because you know, like, especially with ICE and like stuff like that, I'm just like, I grew up always fearing the cops, because it was the cops that like raided like a family member's home of mine. You know, like, it's like the cops that pulled me and my, at that time, white girlfriend over, and then pulling her off to the side and being like, you need to avoid, you know, this person. Yeah, true story. You know, like, this is like, you know, being called the N-word, like, at school. You know what I'm saying? And I'm just kind of like, you know, I really just cannot take y'all seriously anymore. I mean, I never did. I've had like a sliver of hope, but like now it's just kind of like, nah, cooked, honestly. But like,
yeah,
it's just like really infuriating to see how many bootlickers are really out here in these streets. And it made me just realize that for real, like, nobody's coming to save us. We are actually like for real on our own. Thus also like proving the fact that solidarity and mutual aid within marginalized communities are now more than ever important.
That's it. You know, that's all there is.
That's all there is. And I don't do social media anymore because I was just like, this shit is stupid. But like, also, like, once I had a Twitter like way back in the day, but as soon as I learned that that person, whatever, I honestly like deleted that person's name in my brain. But once he took over, I deleted it. Facebook, Meta, like, that became a boomer like hellscape. So I was like, yep, done with this. Instagram, like, that was the same shit. So I know that people like contend that the internet is real life, and like we're seeing it play out with, like, you know, actual government officials like decreeing like official acts.
Yeah.
Sharing investigation materials before it's actually been properly investigated. Like, it's just very unserious at this point. I just like have to wonder. Yeah, like I find myself like wondering, like, also as an artist, like, where do we go from here? Like, if our thoughts and our art is going to be under this like microscope, even more so, like with surveillance and like social media, whatever, where do we find that place to create, but also to make sure that our work is getting to the people that we do the work for?
Oh, man. What a good question that I don't have an answer for.
It's hard. Like, it's really hard to think about it.
I go to events. I meet my colleagues. I meet new people. I think, like, the world before online is the answer. We sold books then, too. Can probably figure it out again. But in general, everything is fragmenting. And the era of the online town square is already over. Well over. So we need to double down on our communities, which was always the case. But now, of course, you know, there's added incentive. That's where real life happens.
So everybody delete your social media. Just go full on Luddite. Like, we're just going to
throw,
like,
your phone into the ocean.
Pigeons and shit. Like,
God, really, I wish, like, the Luddites had won.
Oh, I wish the Luddites had won.
Literally every day I think that.
The first time someone saw an electric loom and was like, this is the end of society. They were right.
They were dead fucking on. Like, they knew. They knew. I saw a documentary about a guy who sells shrooms and delivers them via pigeons. And I've never more been like, what kind of magical ass fucking life are some people living?
And how do I get that?
Yeah. And also, yeah, I've been looking up how far pigeons can fly in case I need to send them to you, Sonia. I'm not even kidding. I really was. I was like, can I get a pigeon to Minnesota?
I wish a pigeon would bring me drugs.
What? That's the most amazing experience. You're like,
right. It's pigeon. Kind of like being St. Francis of Assisi, except you get fucking whipped off your ass.
Yes.
I believe it's called Shrooms for the listeners at home and also for y'all. And it's like 6 minutes. And I think he lives in Barcelona, which is like, well, okay. That explains part of it. Well, there was something you said, Signe, and that I think is like such a common trope you are working with, Gretchen, which is like, no one's coming to save us. Like, no one's coming to save the trans women in Manhunt. No one's coming to save the trans and queer kids in Cuckoo. Like, no one's coming to save Ellen in Black Flame. Like, not without them doing part or all of it themselves, you know?
Yeah.
They have to both find community, which is something that is very difficult to do in each of the situations these people are in, because they all start out to varying degrees of isolated, to varying degrees of broken from each other. And it's exactly what you were saying about real life. You know, then they have to find their community. They have to be able to put their ass on the line for each other. They can't just expect someone else to put their ass on the line first. Someone has to step up first. And that person might die. That person might, and that's just real. For everybody in these books.
Yes, it is.
And I love that theme because I think it is such an important one to talk about in horror. I think it's such an important one to talk about in trans and queer communities and in marginalized communities more broadly. And I think it's honestly like a really great place for us to end this episode and the podcast, which is like, no one's coming to save us, right? Like, we save us. We write our fiction for us. We figure out how to get it to other people, to each other, our films, our whatever delightful things we're trying. I don't know. I might make a zine. Let's see what happens this winter. Winter is long in New England. Who knows?
Very true.
Yeah, maybe I'll learn to weave. I'll weave a story into a pot. I don't know. Never know what I'm going to be doing. I have ADHD. But no one is coming to save us. So we save ourselves and we save each other. And I think that permeates each of your books, that message. And I'll say, I think Black Flame has like maybe the most like mind-bending permutation on it, like of what who your community might be and what acts you might need to do to get together to solidify community. But frankly, I'm in. I just think that's a really incredible message, especially in horror. And it reminds me of something that Tana Nariv Du said in our interview, which is like, horror is preparing you to live. It's preparing you to live in a world where you have to make horrifying decisions every day, where you have to be participant. Oh my God. Oh my God. She was just mind bending. She and Signe had a conversation that's just like, I was just like sobbing. Like, I was just in the background, just sobbing. It was wonderful. I when I think about that, the idea that horror is meant to prepare us, it actually makes me like horror more. Like, I'm more willing to read things that are scarier or harder or more visceral. Like, your work is so fucking visceral. And obviously, especially with talking about sensuality, that's part of your aim, you know? And so, nailed it. But I was willing to go to those scarier, darker places knowing that this is preparing me. And the other piece is horror is like honest about how bad shit is. Horror is like, I'm not going to tell you it's fucking sunshine and roses. I'm going to tell you that sexual violence is real. I'm going to tell you that people will take advantage of you if you're a child or a marginalized person or weaker in some way or disabled or any number of things. But I'm also going to tell you that you can be defiant as fuck. You can be defiant as fuck. You may not win. You may not win. But if you go down swinging, at least they didn't get to say you liked it, you know, on the way out.
Yeah, you can die with a chunk of them in your mouth.
Exactly. Ooh, chills.
Sometimes that's all you can get.
Sometimes that's all you can get. Mm. Mm. Well, I think, Gretchen, this has been just, I couldn't ask for more. You know, if I come up with any questions now, they're going to be a little fluffy. But I do want to hear a little bit about your Patreon, if you don't mind just telling us a little bit about what you like to do there and then giving us the URL, not whatever I said earlier, so that folks can find it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do run a Patreon for film criticism and occasional short stories. I review a mix of new releases, classics, and things that I think are sort of underseen and deserve critical reappraisal. I also run a screening series called the Deadlights Theater, where I run a themed series of 8 screenings a month. We also have a Halloween marathon. This month is zombies. We're doing a bunch of sort of lesser known zombie features for the monthly screenings, and then we're doing Romero and Boyle's zombie trilogies, respectively, the Living Dead series and the 28 Days series for a Halloween marathon. So you can find me under my own name on Patreon.
Fantastic. And where can folks find you elsewhere online?
I'm on Blue Sky, and I guess I'm technically on Instagram, but I don't really use it.
Amazing. Sinya, would you like to tell folks where they can learn more about you or find you?
Nowhere. Absolutely nowhere. I've broken up with the internet in so many fucking ways. I mean, I don't have a Blue Sky, I'm on Black Sky. Big ups to the Black Sky community. I love us. But yeah, for right now, this is where I exist. I am existing here. If you are a My Chemical Romance fan, I'll be at the show next year. I finally got tickets and I'm like, please, can we hold off Civil War until after that's done?
Yeah, that's all we're asking.
That's all we're asking. Yeah.
Well, and if that changes in the future, if you have any projects or anything to share, we will, of course, post it on the Bitches on Comics website. We plan to keep the Bitches on Comics website live for at least the next couple of years so folks can continue to listen to the episodes. I don't know how long they'll still be hosted on whatever platform you're listening on, but if we have to move off that, we will make them available to be listened to on the website. That will be just me doing that, so it might take some time. Wish me all the luck in the world if it comes to that. I want to just say one final thank you to our patrons. You are the reason we've been able to keep the podcast going for as long as we have. Every penny that you have given to us has gone to pay Kate. And I want to say thank you so much, Kate. Catherine Warner at Churchfire Music. Catherine, thank you so much for editing us for 6 years, making us sound fucking awesome, editing out every time I got so excited I jumbled my words, which I apologize for being more often than I like, but you made me sound very professional, and for that I am grateful. I'd also like to thank all of our listeners. Anybody who's ever tuned in, if this is your first time tuning in, don't worry, there's at least 199 episodes before this that you can listen to, and we hope you will. We will still have ads on the podcast and keep our Patreon live through the end of the year, which is only a couple more months here, because that will help us pay for our tax preparation for next year. But, you know, I want to say thanks. It's been an incredible 6 years. I have learned a lot. I can't believe the amazing people I've gotten to speak to about horror, about comics, about sci-fi fantasy. I have laughed more than I ever dreamed I would get to do talking to people who are so cool and so smart, like today's guest, Gretchen, who's still hanging out for this little goodbye. I just want to say thank you to everybody, and thank you, Gretchen. Thank you, Sinye, for being here with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad I got to play you guys out.
Yes, it was a perfect.
This is rad. This is rad.
For one last time, this is Bitches on Comics, and I'm S. E. Fleenor. Thanks for listening.